The Changing Face of Ronaldsway. It is sometimes difficult to imagine what that area, now enclosed by the airport, really looked like prior to it having to endure those great earth-moving machines that put the hills into the hollows and demolished three of the island's finest farms. Away back in the 1930s, a small field situated behind the Derby Haven houses and hotel was used for light aircraft. In 1940 to 42, these fields were used by the number one ground defense gunnery school when it then moved to Douglas. The big task then began of constructing about a square mile of land into a military base. Lang's contractors of Carlisle shipped heavy machinery to the island and began what appeared to be a colossal task of leveling this irregular portion of the country. Cattle, sheep and horses grazed peacefully on the fields of lush grass. Acres of corn, potatoes and turnips were quickly harvested. Milking cows, pigs and hens came under the auctioneer's hammer. The Clydesdale and Shire horses, some of the best in the land, disappeared from the stables. The lack of cultivators, implements, carts and binders from the haggards and yards made the place look desolate and lonely. One day I walked behind a line of two dozen cattle that were fastened in the stalls of the beef house. The next, the powerful teeth of the diesel grab was tearing at the gable wall of that same building. Large granite cornerstones and limestone slabs falling into the metal box of the dumper. A vertical section displaying a quantity of hay on the stable loft, some of it trailing into the slatted wooden manger below. Three rich agricultural farms occupied the site of the now busy Ronaldsway Airport. The first of these farms was called the Craggans, meaning the rocks, and situated where the now entrance to the airport terminal. The workers' cottages being on the opposite side of the road, to the west, and at a point where the Ronaldsway aircraft works, are found in a field known as the Bishop's Belly. The last farmer here was Percy Kermit. The second important farm was Ballagillia, or McGill or Gill's farm. The entrance to it was immediately to the south of the exit gate from the airport terminal. The lane then turned further southwards for about 300 yards. A very deep domestic water well was within the yard. After the bulldozers had rid the site of all the buildings, the deep well was left as a gaping round hole in the earth, which was then covered over by long slabs and overlaid with concrete. This well will probably be under the perimeter carriageway. The last farmer here was Finlow Corkle. The third large farm was that of Ronaldsway. This name was from a Scandinavian warrior called Reginald, now Ronald, and his way was a narrow strip of land between Sandwick on the west of the peninsula and Derby Haven on the east, where the flat-bottom boats could be hauled from one side to the other. But the farm of that name is further along the coast to the east and divided from the parish of Santon by the Santon Burn at Casnowen. The remains of the farm buildings are an obvious spectacle, where the road continued from Derby Haven through the farm to pass Balthane into Ballasalla. It is now removed because of the extended runways to the coast. So, with the erection of brick huts, having corrugated roofs at Ballasalla and Janet's Corner to accommodate military personnel, a training centre began in 1944 for the Royal Naval Air Station and commissioned as a fleet air arm base called HMS Early, a Manx word for eagle, although being Manx should have been pronounced Erla. Its chief use was the training of crews for operational flying of the Barracuda dive bomber planes of the torpedo squadron, which continued there until 1946. Many years later, the airport was purchased by the Manx government for approximately £150,000, about the cost of a large bungalow nowadays. It was officially opened in June 1953 by the then Governor Dundas as the island's airport. There were some interesting buildings erected on the airport in the days of HMS Early. One which intrigued me was the tall TAT, Torpedo Attack Trainer. It was like being inside a huge unbroken eggshell, the wider end resting on the ground, completely dark inside, except for controlled electrolluminations, as in a cinema, where the rays could be focused onto a selected area. Members of the crew, while training here, sat in a moving chair, trainer's cockpit, at the highest part of the building, and looked down onto a rippling green floor far below. The rippling green being a simulation of the sea, upon which was placed a tiny model of a particular enemy battleship. The training crews were expected to identify and name the object. The lighting system could be operated to project the appearance of a moonlight night, starlit night, misty night, and a score of other changing conditions. I was friendly with a lively young naval officer, a sub-lieutenant by the name of Ashby, during the closing days of HMS Early. He made a kite of thin strips of wood and tissue paper. A handful of cotton wool soaked in diesel oil, fastened to a cross strip inside the box, was lighted. The hot air caused the kite to rise and drift before the wind for more than half a mile, when it suddenly dropped into the centre of a field of ripening corn, which soon began to flare up in a cloud of smoke. Four of us mounted an Austin utility van with two hand fire extinguishers and drove to the field. The outbreak was soon under control, and only a few yards of the corn was damaged. A remarkable journey for a driverless pony. The owner of this lovely little brown pony was Jack Payne, of Cumberland origin, who lived at the Calia, near Foxdale. He was very fond of the jock, the drink, and could scarcely pass an hotel without slipping in for a little drop. He had the grazing rights of South Barule, Lanagraw, and Clonknarlay, as well as the farms of Ballymona, Killea and Skird. The Skird farm, which was situated on the high ground between the Slock and Airystain, has narrow, twisting, rough approach lanes, especially the one from the east side. It was a dry, windy day in April when Jack took a trip to see Joe Tasker, his steward, in the Skird farm. The pony was unharnessed from the small two-seater gig and put into the stable to enjoy some oats and hay, while his master viewed this rough, mountainous estate. A few sheep of a heavier breed than those he had had on Barool, a large white sow poked its snout over the pigsty wall and grunted loudly as the stranger's presence, for it was rarely that the public would be going there, or anyone would come that way, although there was a public mountain track from Glengaig on the Slock Road to Airystain Colby Road. After a cup of tea from Mrs. Tasker, the pony was taken from the stable and placed between the shafts of the small, well-sprung carriage. Joe bid a pleasant good afternoon, and Jack Payne, with a rein in each hand, set the pony into a steady trot down the headland of two fields, fording the river near the overflow of the reservoir, then crossing the middle of Keelwater Field to enter a winding lane, so narrow in parts that the wheel axles touched the high sod hedges on both sides. A deep ditch, some 3 feet wide, bordered another section. It then turned sharp left into Ballycannell Yard, passing in front of the dwelling house, and another half mile to Ballymore, with a further mile to reach the Colby Round Table Road. From here, and with less than a mile uphill towards Barool, here is a large stone-built house, known to the older people as Kitty Tommy Hall's, but having the more modern name of the Round Table Inn. The last licensees were James and Julia Corn, but the pub was particularly known as Jim Dick's. It ceased to become a licensed premises in the middle 20s. When Jack Payne approached this embracing spot on his journey home, the urge for a drop of the crater took hold. He hailed young Ernie, a lad of 13 years who was passing at that time, and offered him tuppence if he would mind the pony for a few minutes. But the minutes went on to an hour, and no sign of Jack coming out. So young Ernie jumped over the hedge and ran away home. The pony, finding it was alone and probably thinking of the oats and hay in the stable at Skird, turned around and trotted back along the way it had come, the little driverless gig bouncing behind it. Down it went to the three roads, negotiating the quick turn into the dusty way up to Airystain, passing Ballymore, through Ballycannell Yard, into the hazardous, narrow, winding lane across the fields, fording the river along the headland of the two fields to reach Skird farmyard. That same stable door was wide open when the pony sprightly trotted between the frames, but the shafts became wedged in the opening. The frightened animal jumped from one side to the other, finally breaking the shafts and freeing itself from its burden. A little later, the trap was found blocking the doorway, and the little brown Topsy nibbling at the hay in the manger, the traces dangling on the floor. It was then that the mystery began. Had Jack come to grief somewhere in the vicinity? Had something dreadful befallen him on his way, on the unacquainted path? No one had any idea. 3 miles away, Jack stepped out of the Round Table Inn over 2 hours after he had entered to find the roadway empty. Both the pony and trap and Ernie had gone. Yet another mystery remained. Had Ernie gone for a drive, or had he left his post? If the latter, then the pony would probably have set off for home to the Kalia and Ballymona. So Jack, after some discussion, decided to walk the further 3 miles home. I do not know what occurred after that, except to say that a lad was sent on foot across the moors to the Kalia with a message that Topsy was safe, but the gig was shaftless. No one could ever understand how that little pony negotiated some of the worst and most difficult tracks in the country. There is one thing sure, it didn't have anything to drink at Jim Dick's. Racing Recollections. The TT motorcycle race has always been an attraction for lads, whatever the period. But a little reflection of the 1920s has an enduring thrill. The old water-cooled Scott Squirrel, the Cotton, Levis, Panther, Rudge, HRD, Rex Acme, the AGS, Douglas, Raleigh, are some of the great speedsters of the day. It all started when an older school lad went with his father to see the TT races in June of that year. The next day, he described almost non-stop what he had seen at Ballycrane Corner. The bikes were travelling like lightning, he said. You watch them coming round in the distance, then, whiz, they disappeared around the corner in a cloud of smoke. After listening to his account of spills and thrills, I there and then made up my mind that by hook or by crook, I would see them for myself, the exciting moments of those daring men on machines the following year. I had just learned to ride an old lady's push bike, so, failing any other improved form of transport, the loan of that old bike would serve the purpose. By the following year, I had acquired a second-hand push bike for 5 shillings. The Moor boys of Balladool were the envy of the school. They were riding around on 2 brand-new bikes and just the right height for their yet not fully developed legs. It was thinning turnip time, a time when the children got half of their summer school holidays. Though we were busy thinning ridges of turnips for a penny halfpenny 100 yards, we were allowed to go to see the races and arrived at Ballycrane in good time, having found a berth on a sod bank. The starter gun was sounding from the grandstand. Then, what seemed like hours, the first machine was heard roaring in the distance. Actually, it was only minutes. The excitement and anticipation was reaching the peak when someone shouted, "Here he is." And what a surprise for me. For that whiz-whiz and disappearing in a cloud of smoke, as the older school lad had so emphatically declared 12 months before, did not happen. I was left bewildered at the slowness in rounding the corner. As the race continued, it became evident that it was not slow, for a rider hit the gable end of the hotel, his bike lying in the roadway as he scrambled along the ditch in an effort to avoid any mishap by oncoming riders, for one was rapidly approaching at that moment, but was moving cautiously after observing the marshal's red flag. After 2 or 3 laps, we moved off to reach that well-known and thrilling sight at the Humpback Bridge at Belleg, about 200 yards beyond Ballaspur, which takes the traffic over the River Neb. It was a much more severe and sharper hump than that at Balaff. A notable character who stood at Ballacrane that day, and indeed for many years afterwards, when races were held, was that formidable Reverend Stennings, a science master at King William's College, who later became Archdeacon Stenning. His muffled bass voice and blinking eyebrows made him very outstanding as he looked through his binoculars and announced the distant riders approaching. Although the road surfaces were bumpy and rough in the 1920s, the greatest and most outstanding changes have been in the machines, for those earlier bikes did not have foolproof foot change gears, nor did they experience twist-drip control. It was hard work to negotiate the 37¾ miles round the course, for when approaching a corner, 2 levers on the right-hand side of the wide handlebars had to be quickly set. The smaller top one determined the amount of air. The larger underneath one worked the carburetor needle. Then the hand was smartly dropped to the gear change lever between the rider's knees and the petrol tank. This would occur 3 or 4 times for each formidable bend. Neither were these gears synchromeshed, and some horrible grinds would be heard about 100 yards from the corner. There was a third important lever on the bars. It advanced or retarded the ignition spark, and was very important when accelerating after a bend or climbing a hill. The rider was aware of something far greater than these already mentioned. The oiling system was such that too much oil swamped the plugs, and too little caused the metal to heat and expand, and finally seize up. So 2 methods were commonly adopted. Either the engine forced some to pass into a glass chamber, then manually controlled to drip at a pace desired by the rider. It was called the drip feed. The other was the manual pump feed, a small hand pump situated on either the one side or along the side of the tank, and was pulled up and depressed every few miles, again at the discretion of the driver. I should mention also that those oils thinned out or became more liquid as it heatened, unlike the multigrade refined lubricants of today. Hard work indeed, both mentally and physically, for those boys who roared around the course at 60 and 70 miles an hour. Perhaps repair a puncture on the way. A lot of water has gone under Braddon Bridge since Tom Sheard done his winning lap on that T.T. Douglas. Pa Cowley with his sit-up-and-beg handlebars. The famous Freddie Dixon with his lever-controlled sidecar making the thrills. And the boys and girls from many lands who enjoyed having sandwiches while sitting on the sod hedges. St. John's Meadow and Mound. When I was quite young, I occasionally came into contact with an elderly gentleman who in his younger days resided in the sunset city of Peel. He then moved to Balaclferic in Russian. He was known as Dick Atay. He had a keen interest in forecasting the weather for the coming year by observing the first 12 days in January, each day representing a month. If a day was wet, so would that particular month it represented be wet. He related that one year it snowed heavily on the seventh day, which represented the month of July. An unlikely month for snow on this island. And here I should like to use his own words as closely as my memory will allow. I left Balaclferic pretty early in the morning to walk to the Midsummer Fair, he declared. The old folk called Tynwald the gathering on the 5th of July Midsummer Fair for some reason or other. When I got to Foxdale, it began to snow, so I hurried to catch under the railway bridge for shelter. Quite a number of people of old who took note of the first 12 days had forgotten about them as the year went by. The early years of this century brought much different types of stallholders to the Tynwald Fair ground. One woman from Laxey with her teenage son had a cardboard donkey suspended from a pole, which they called Maud. Maud had a hole about the size of a saucer in the centre. If a ball was thrown through this opening, it released a spring which allowed the rear part or the heels of the donkey to quickly rise. The old lady, while collecting loose balls from the floor, kept shouting, "3 pence to see Kickin' Mard," while the slow, quiet lad, holding 3 balls in his hand, exclaimed, "3 pence to see Mard kick." At another stall was a white-coated gent posing as a quack doctor, with a variety of pills on the table. He shouted to the ambling crowd, "Come and banish your ailments by taking my pill. I have a cure for all your common troubles." He sold a box to a lady with backache, and a blue packet to a bowler-hatted man for failing eyesight. A young farm labourer began heckling the stallholder. The sprightly doctor asked him, had he any ailments?
No,
he sharply answered. Do you sleep well? He asked. Me? Laughed the man. I could sleep all night and all day.
Ah,
I thought you had a complaint. You should get sufficient sleep in 8 hours. Here, buy a box and take one each night, and it'll put you right. At another stall was a long ladder with varying spaces between the rungs. The broad-shouldered man of about 12 stone took bets as to whether he could squeeze his body through the numbered openings. I can go through the eye of a needle without touching either side, he yelled. Someone in the audience claimed that the ladder had expanding rungs. There were those with cures for warts, and a chiropodist displaying a long-handled razor. Don't split your foot. Open with this ugly weapon, he demonstrated. Use a few drops for 3 nights of my special formula, and you'll never have a harvest on your feet again. No corns. Oh, yes, the Tynwald scene has altered. The quarterland of Balladoyne and the area around the stately granite-faced church has been transformed into a site of immense beauty. The old meadow, the Linney, it used to be called, is now bedecked with flowering shrubs and young trees. Each island parish, given a portion for its own. The lush grass to tread on, soft and quiet. The aroma of the tall red clover and the short white just peeping between the grass. A little bit of Curragh marsh and wild bird pond in the making, with 3 ducks or widgeons claiming an early home. Clean hardwood seats dispersed along the sunny sheltered slope. What a charm for mind and body. A health-giving relaxation away from the highway noise, the maddening crowd, the daily toil to walk or sit in peace and comfort. Even an arrangement of music from our feathered friends from the wren to the rook in the tall trees that afford shade when the sun does its best. Even the gateway gives the appearance of entering a palace. Yindlesack the Jarrow, wonderful indeed. Come, factory worker or housewife from your bench, or toiling on the land, just leave your ploughing. There's such a changing scene assured, laid out for you and free around Keelowen. Three forms of transport. There were 3 great and distinct advancements in our island's transport. The first, and probably the greatest, was that welcomed event of the steam railway system. Can you imagine the difference between sitting in an uncovered, horse-drawn cart from Balaff to Ramsey on a snowing winter's day, or from Grenaby to Douglas in a pony trap on a rainy December morn, over muddy, bumpy roads to reach the important market areas to sell the farm produce, or to sit in your station waiting room for the approach of a comfortable, cushioned carriage with hot water bottles for your feet to travel at a speed of up to 25 miles an hour. This rail service commenced in 1873, or just over 106 years ago, having an unrivaled service until the early part of the 1920s. During this period, hundreds of sacks of corn were carted from the outlying farms of Arbury to Castletown Station, where a most suitable siding and goods shed allowed trucks to be shunted for loading purposes. To reach this place, a bit of navigation was necessary. From Ballabeg, we journeyed over the bridge by Ballabeg Station, down the new road to Ballykegan, to the Plough Inn, and over the Dumb River to enter Arbury Street of the metropolis. This extremely narrow street always gave interesting problems. On one occasion, the Farmers Club coal boat was unloading at the quay, and three loaded carts came rattling towards our three carts of loaded grain. Who had the right of way? It is not too easy to reverse a laden stiff cart. To add to the confusion, a float had pulled out of Tom Dodd's yard. The driver gave an unpleasant yell that made the farm labourers hastily withdraw their cargoes of black winter fuel tightly to one side, as the floatman, walking backwards, gently coaxing his eager pony through the passage, one wheel on the footpath, the other narrowly missing the cart axle. We then followed his pattern. The most difficult part was mounting the pavement with the ironclad wheel. The journey then continued round the castle, over the swing bridge, along Victoria Road to the railway goods shed. How much our journey could have been shortened if the bypass had been in existence then? Or had there been a railway siding and loading bay at Ballabeg? It was this latter omission that was greatly responsible for the second transport advent. Caller Sons and Cowley were the island's largest and most progressive seed merchants, with their warehouses situated in Douglas. They supplied the farmers with seeds and implements, and in return purchased nearly all their grain and produce. It was reported at that time that both farmers and merchants had requested the Isle of Man Railway Company to lay a side line and loading bay at Ballabeg Station. This they declined to do. In consequence of this, Corlett and Cowley's had purchased petrol-driven lorries so as to reach the outlandish farms. Thus the railway was deprived of that business. The first two petrol wagons purchased by the merchants were Hadfield Bean. One was driven by Tom Firth. The license number was MN4779. The other was under the control of Charlie Smith. Both were fitted with pneumatic tyres. This firm also had steam-driven lorries, which were chiefly used in the town for conveying goods to and from the boats and such like. Occasionally they would be seen chugging along the country lane to the amazement and excitement of the staring children, who called them buzzy wagons. The fast-moving puffs of smoke rising above the cab give the appearance of a busy, cheeky, energetic locomotive buzzing around. The third great change came in 1926. A bus service conveying passengers to parts of the island hitherto unreached. St. Mark's had for the first time a bus service passing through the hamlet. Andreas, Bride, Croncavaddy were some of the places that enjoyed this regular passenger transport. The departure point in Lord Street, Douglas, on a Saturday night was exciting to watch. Three bus companies were now operating from this street. The Manxland, the Manx Motors, and the Road Services, the Blue Railway Company buses. The opposition from each of the three companies brought cut-price tickets and greatly reduced fares. This meant that the population took advantage of a Saturday night jaunt and overcrowding of the transport system. Old Bill Siddons from Port St. Mary was a conductor on the Manxland bus, ready to depart from Castledown Marketplace, when a woman came running up shouting, "Are you full up?" "Me," said Bill. "I'm not allowed to touch a single pint on this job." Now, that is remembering three progressive, pleasant forms of transport for our island.